Chapter 36. September AD 2063. Year 7, ERC, Spring. My name is Wu Ji. I'm speaking to you from the Pioneer 14 craft, which has just, for the first time, cast off from the Lodestone complex. Still drifting through the deep shadow of the Earth, we await the sunlight. And today we begin a mission that will take us out of the Sun's planetary system altogether. We are a crew of three, right now sitting side by side in our couches, in a cramped control cabin that doubles as an escape pod, incidentally. For safety reasons, we also wear pressure suits, as you can see in the visual feeds. When we are underway, we will open up the rest of our ship. I am sure you know who we are by now. But for the record, on this launch day, aboard with me is Marina Petko, citizen of Russia, who is now the last survivor of the Almirik mission to Mars, a mission which fell foul of the Blink. Here also is Sarah West, citizen of the American Free States, best known as an engineer and business associate of Serena Jones of Jones Inc. With her engineering knowledge, as well as her managerial skills, business acumen and general good judgment, Sarah has done a great deal to help stabilize and progress the Pioneer project after the Pathfinder incident at Mercury 2 years ago. Of all of us, Sarah has the least experience of spaceflight. For her, before this, only the shuttle from Earth to the Lodestone and tours of duty there. They were extensive tours, however. She is a veteran, and I am proud to have her at my side. I am Wu Shi. I am a citizen of the People's Republic of China. I am the son of the prominent scientist Wu Yan, and I am proud too of her achievements, even if I am as baffled by them, as ignorant of them, as many of you must be, as I live on the wrong side of various security barriers. Well, I have chosen to live that way. For myself, I am best known for my long tours of duty at the Lodestone Station, here in Earth's shadow, and where this new Pioneer craft has been constructed. I could have no better crewmates. I'm checking my mission clock. We have many milestones to achieve in this early phase of the mission. A burst of action for a few days, followed by a calm cruise into the deep outer solar system. A cruise at least a year long, if we are to reach the Blink location 90 astronomical units out, and perhaps travel beyond. And it may puzzle those of you who are not yet so familiar with the parameters of our mission, or you have forgotten, over all these years of preparation, that to begin with we will be exploiting not dark energy, sparse and mysterious, but sunlight, the warm and abundant energy that quickens the Earth itself. Skythrust 2 hovered high over Naples. From within a viewing lounge, Mel Kapoor peered out at the ash column that towered over the city. Pale sunlight played on the column, casting a shadow kilometres long. Wu Ji's voice from space, relayed over Mel's phone, was a background sound. Almost soothing, Mel thought. Calm words from a million kilometres away. Calm and meaningless. Jane wandered into the lounge, looked around, sat in a window chair far from everybody else. She wore grubby dungarees, as she had since her pickup. Her hair had been roughly shaved down to the scalp, leaving bright red bristles. Subtle glances among the adults here in this lounge. Mel, Grace Butterworth, Harry Regent. Don't say anything. Don't go pricking her pride or sparking her temper. Just let her be. Mel herself carefully didn't react. So far as she knew, this was the first time her daughter had left her cell, as she called her cabin on Skythrust, since being extracted more or less forcibly from the heart of Naples 24 hours before. Mel hadn't actually been allowed to touch her 17-year-old daughter, not once, since Jane had been brought aboard. Jane just wouldn't have it. Not yet, so Mel thought hopefully. Right here, right now, it was enough consolation for Mel that at least her daughter was with her, in this aerial refuge, rather than down on the ground. That dangerous ground. The light shifted. Mel turned back to the window. After 3 days, the ash column rising above the Campi Flegrei was growing denser, more turbulent. Was the view still more awesome viewed from the air than the ground? That dark, irregular pillar, so thick in its central sections it looked almost liquid, and yet reaching for the stratosphere like some great arm raising a fist. Yes, it awed her, as nothing had since the blink itself. Like an astronomical phenomenon brought down to Earth. And you are an astronomer, Mel. Yes, but astronomy is supposed to be about stuff safely far away. She felt like a moth before a flamethrower. We need to get down there, murmured Grace. Maybe prompted by Jane showing up. I need to get down there. The last message I got from Ella, she was still there, in that soccer stadium. And Billy was with her then, at least. Ella was Grace's sister, and Billy her daughter. Grace's 6-year-old niece. A blink baby, born on that fateful day itself. And, to some, an object of superstitious dread ever since. They seemed to be the only family Grace had, or that she would admit to, which was why she had come so far to try to find them. Grace clenched and unclenched her own fists as she stood by the big picture window of this ornate suite and gazed down at the cityscape, shadowed by the ash column. Harry Regent, as ever stiff and upright in his crisp USAF uniform, put a hand on Grace's shoulder. Then that's where they most likely still are, in the stadium. Ella knew you were coming. And she knows that if we're able to attempt any kind of retrieval, it will be from her last known location. She wouldn't move away without telling you. And she wouldn't let herself be separated from Billy, not at such a time. We have to plan for the best case, I guess, until we know otherwise. Grace just glowered. A frighteningly powerful expression, Mel thought. What? This is the best case. Billy and Ella lost in a crowd of, what, 100,000? More, maybe, Jane said. It's the Stadio San Paolo. Napoli play there. She glanced at Harry. Soccer? Harry forced a grin. I did know that. Grace snapped. When is that damn captain going to make a decision? Mel knew she meant the commander of Skythrust. Harry sighed. Well, it's complicated. I spoke to her a while back. Right now, she could still send down another chopper. They've been experimenting with gauze covers over the engine vents and so forth. But none of it is tried and tested. The ash is thickening all the time, and it blows about in clumps. I'm sure her strategy is to wait for a break, clear spell, a change in the wind. But overall, the ashfall is getting worse, not better, right? Yes, and that's the dilemma right there. Because if she waits too long, any pickup's impossible, anyhow. Shame it wasn't impossible earlier. James snapped. I spent days down there before I was forcibly evacuated, on my mother's orders. Mel thought that was about as much of a cue as she was going to get. Blame me if you want, she said. Jane turned on her. The evidence of the medical work on her face was still obvious, stitches slowly dissolving in the deep cut on her cheek. Jane said savagely, I do blame you. I'm old enough to make my own choices about my own life. I had a job to do. I was doing it well, too. I was saving lives, or trying to. Look, I was useful down there. Look at it. Okay, I'm looking. Harry walked over to a window, peered out, and said, diplomatically, it seemed to Mel. So tell me what I'm looking at. That's one big city. Jane, apparently distracted, mildly mollified, got up and joined Harry at the window. Grace followed, and Mel. Mel leaned over the back of an ornate couch to see. Naples. It was built around a bay. She stared down at a half moon of grey sea pushing into the land. Mel glimpsed an elaborate water frontage, buildings no doubt impossibly ancient, and a dense carpet of buildings sprawling behind. Jane said, You're looking at the third largest conurbation in Italy, after Milan and Rome itself. See the harbour? The city centre is just north of that, a comparatively well-off location. I was only there because I knew you would have your goons come for me, Mum, when I was trying to hide away. If I'd known you'd stuck a tracking chip in me when I was a baby, the source of long, bleak arguments since the pickup, Mel had no regrets. Most of the relief work I was engaged on was further to the north. See the suburbs around the old airport. In sunlight diluted by the ash tower, Mel thought she could make out a tracery of runways. Shantytown now, horrific poverty, diseases running wild through populations of street kids. Even before Blink Day, I was told. I did follow your feed, you know, Mel said. To get here, Jane had defied every injunction her mother had laid down, and yet, in the end, the images Jane had sent back had been remarkable. The slim, fragile teenager, in a battered, patched-up hazard suit, carrying inoculation kits towards mobs of half-feral street kids. But now Jane twisted away. You followed me? Why? So what? So you could brag about me with your damn in-joke cronies? If you had paid any attention to what I was actually doing, you'd have let me be. Harry said, You must have had warnings to evacuate as soon as the ash plume started. I mean, it was a Europe-wide phenomenon after 24 hours. Flights grounded from Britain to the Urals. Well, all save airships like this one and a few other specialist craft. Jane said tiredly, Of course I knew about the warnings, including from my mother. Yammering away, breaking through every filter I could put on my calls. But what was I supposed to do? Even if I got out myself, you should have seen them. All those grimy little kids. Everyone was just baffled. The world had already let them down. And their government. And then the ash plume began. Was I supposed to abandon them too? I couldn't just leave. Mel suppressed a sigh. You'll never know how proud I am. But I'm your mother. I couldn't abandon you. Harry asked, How did you find her? Contacts, Jane broke in. She called on her friend Tash, and she arranged for my chip to be tracked. Yes, Mel said. I called in favours. The English were already monitoring Naples, and when I knew where you were, and I found out the skyship was coming over, and the projections were getting worse... In the final terrible few days of anxiety and indecision, Mel, like the whole world, had followed the news from Naples with growing alarm. Indeed, since the blink, Mel knew, the geologists had watched such locations with dismay as Earth and Moon settled into their new changed orbits, and the Earth's mantle, that global underground sea of molten rock, perturbed by the new tidal stresses, became energetic as if awoken. And had evidently begun probing for weak spots in the overlying crust. Weak spots such as the Campi Flegrei, near Naples. The big caldera under the fields of fire, sitting over a huge magma mass, was already scarred by a massive detonation from the time of the Neanderthals, and had long been a candidate site for a new eruption, sometime in the future. But that future had been fast-forwarded by the blink. A few weeks back, it had begun with earthquakes, some major. One runway in the main city airport had been cracked, and some more minor, transient. Jane had lived through these. She had said the quakes sounded like distant thunder, felt like a goods train passing by. American friends said it was like living in California. Then, days ago, the ash plumes had started. The ash was a symptom of the magma rising from beneath, pushing up against a lid of rock until it cracked, and an ash of rock dust and flakes was expelled and rose high into the air, even into the stratosphere, from where it had crossed a continent, grounding flights, clogging machinery, and making populations choke. This hadn't been the first volcanic ash plume since the blink, but this one over Naples had evidently been only a prelude to a more major event, so the geologists reluctantly agreed. Which was why Mel had been desperately looking for a way to bring her daughter out. It wasn't easy. The gathering ash cloud over the city was not just obstructing overflights, it was also blocking the view from satellites. The rest of the world couldn't even see what was going on at Naples, let alone help constructively. Then she heard about Skythrust. The inspection mission had been hastily put together by the English and Australian authorities. The vacuum-lifted Skythrust needed no engines to keep it aloft, of course. Its big, languid, directional turbines were thought to be robust enough to be able to withstand the ash-laden air. where conventional aircraft were struggling. Drone robots had quickly been improvised to sweep ashfall off the big solar energy farm on the craft's upper hull, and so on. Skythrust could get closer to the incipient volcano than any other aircraft, and Mel had pulled every string she could, starting with Tash and Charlie Marlowe, to get a place on the flight. She hadn't been too surprised to find Harry Regent already aboard, as a military attaché to a group of US-based observers, and Mel suspected cynically because of his high-profile status as hero astronaut. "Hey, we can't send any food or aid or get anybody out, but look at our handsome hero Skyboy." It was more of a surprise that Grace Butterworth was here. The justification was her ongoing role as an aide to the English Science Minister, and some of Fred Bowles' juniors were on board. Mel understood Grace's true motivation for being here, of course, the same as Mel's own, family. Well, Grace's apparent motivation, as Tash had speculated before they had left England, if vaguely. There seemed to be other agendas at play here. During the slow flight from Newcastle, Mel had observed Harry and Grace spending long hours together, talking, Grace generally angrily, Harry more calmly, yet both with intent. If Mel didn't know better, she might have thought they were plotting something, but she had not the faintest idea what. Anyhow, that had had nothing to do with Mel's own objective for this trip, nothing at all. Now Grace sighed. "Look, kid, your mum saw a chance, and she had to take it. I will if I get close enough to Ella and Billy, and I wish they were chipped." She was cut off by a distant rumble. They looked at each other, and Skythrust shuddered hugely, as if gut-punched from below. They stumbled, staggered, grabbed for handholds. "I hope you can make out what we're showing you, or trying to. Obviously we are not yet out in the sunlight. We inch that way cautiously, behind small tug craft that are pulling us out of the umbra, the long shadow of Earth. But we have already unfurled our sail. Spots from the lodestone are casting light over that huge, gauzy structure. Can you see it? You may need some imagination to assemble these random splashes of light into an integrated structure. It is easier for us. We know the geometry of our craft intimately, not to mention having simulated this sequence many times over. To clarify, for the first part of our mission, the structure will act as a solar sail, and only later as a ram scoop inlet. The sail, at this moment, is all of 40 kilometers in diameter. It is connected to our tiny hull by carbon fiber threads, a spider's web which sustains and controls the sail in flight. We can adjust its shape. We can send micro drones down the threads if repairs are needed, and so on. The sail far exceeds our tiny habitat in size, but is only maybe a third of its mass. The ship and habitat together weigh around 400 tons. Still, 40 kilometers, the size of a major city. But the material is smart, and in the course of our flight it will spin itself out into a much larger form, fit for a much more ambitious purpose. Far from the sun, far out in the dark, to maintain our acceleration it will mine the dark energy field. So, as our predecessors have done for a century or more now, we astronauts work through our checklists, completing tasks that we have studied, brainstormed, planned, with contingencies to work around any failure we could think of. Contingencies rehearsed and simulated over and over until we could do it all blindfolded, literally. But now, at last, the sail is deployed. And now we look forward to our next mission milestone. Sunrise. Sunrise. After that first sudden jolt, the ship had seemed to calm. Even now, Mel listened with half an ear to Xi, an in-joke in deep space. But that word resonated in her head. Sunrise. For he had said it just as a kind of sunrise glow seemed to rise up from the land below. The ship moved. With a surprisingly sharp lurch given its bulk, Skythrust suddenly lifted into the air and started to tip. In this fancy lounge, Mel was still leaning against that ornate couch, which luckily, or by design, seemed to be bolted to the floor. Now she clung to it desperately and looked around. She saw Grace, Harry, her daughter, sprawling. They had all got some kind of purchase. Grace seemed to have fallen across Harry, close to the lounger's bar, and they had their arms locked together. And there was Jane, braced against a wall, clinging to a fire extinguisher bracket. Safe and stable, but far away from Mel, or Grace. Mel grabbed tighter hold of her couch and pulled herself closer to the window on the side the sunrise had seemed to come from, lifted herself up to see. She was looking towards the Campi Flegre, to the west of the city centre, and it really was as if a glaring ruddy dawn shone up from the ground. It illuminated the huge days-old ash column from below, casting strange vertical shadows up through the murk. A staggering sight to Mel. The shadows themselves must have been hundreds of metres tall. Then the noise came, like a thunderclap, but overwhelmingly more powerful. The floor lurched up under her as the shock hit the sky thrust. Mel lost her grip, fell on her back. She landed on the carpet and slid over the tipping floor. The carpet burned her neck, the palms of her hands. Frantically, she reached for the leg of the couch, grabbed it, and hung on tight, stopping her slide. She heard Harry calling names, checking if everybody was okay. But the ferocious, continuing roar from outside almost drowned his voice and their replies in turn. The floor tipped further. Mel just hung on. She couldn't see Jane or hear her. Then the floor tilted another way, back again. Skythrust was twisting, turning, tipping, almost tumbling in the air. This massive slab of a ship, she thought, picturing it in her mind's eye, thrown like a leaf in an autumn storm. The tilt worsened further. Mel shifted her position, trying to hold on tighter. Mel started to fear that the whole ship might turn turtle altogether. In which case, she imagined, in such an unstable configuration, with the lift pods under the bulk of the hull, Skythrust would quickly break up. Even the main decks were meant to hang in the air, not bear weight. She imagined it, the ceiling become a floor beneath her, crumbling and cracking, until she fell out into a tormented sky. A scene just seconds away, maybe. Jane, falling. No! Mel tried to push herself away from the couch, to scramble somehow to Jane. Still, the floor under her tipped and lurched, until it reached an extreme limit and slowly, ponderously, started to drop back down. Mel, face down, scratched at the thick carpet, trying to get some purchase to save from sliding, and she twisted her neck, tried to look around. That roar from outside the hull continued, but the four of them in the cabin, acting from instinct, just held on to the furniture, lying on the tipping floor, watching each other, waiting. Any attempts at speech drowned out by the ongoing explosion beneath them. At last, the nose of Skythrust dropped down, and the craft shuddered to a kind of stability, at a slight lean. As soon as she could, Mel pulled herself to her feet and staggered across the room to Jane, who was sprawled on the floor, still clinging to her extinguisher bracket. Jane's eyes were closed. Oh God, oh God. Mel knelt and held her. Jane stayed stiff for 1 second, a second which broke Mel's heart just a little more. And then she softened into the hug. Grace looked bewildered. What the hell just happened? Harry Regent shook his head. He stood unsteadily, brushed down a crumpled jacket, and looked out of the cabin windows. A strange light played on the planes of his face. I think a volcano happened. Come look. Dizzy, disoriented, and the right-hand side on which she had fallen feeling bruised as hell, maybe even carpet burned, Mel worked her way around the wall, handhold to handhold, to Harry's side. Jane followed, and then Grace. They saw it in the rear windows. The Skythrust was fleeing now, fleeing from the mushroom cloud expanding over the Campi Flegre. The days-old ash column was already scattered, shredded by greater, hotter air masses rising from below, masses thick with smoke and dust and glowing rock fragments, all lifted high into the air from a brilliant, hellish pinpoint on the broken ground. and at the pillar's broadening base, waves of smoke and ash billowed out, flooding across the ground, obscuring it. Whole inner suburbs of the city were already engulfed, Mel saw, by ash waves taller than buildings. Jane said dully. We've talked it all through, down on the ground. Well, we had geologists with us. When an eruption is coming, you get to this column. Masses of material held up in the air by the heat flow from below. As long as that lasts. But when the root energy dies a bit, and the column gives way and falls back, the floor gave another lurch. Mel grabbed instinctively for support. She found Jane's hand, by some primal instinct. Jane let her keep hold. The ship was accelerating now, fleeing faster away from the central zone. Shit! The anger just burst out of Grace. She ran to a wall and slammed her fist against a window, making Mel flinch. But the window, built for the pressures of extreme altitude, held. Shit! Christ! You bastard! Her face was twisted with anger and grief. You bastard! We have to get down there! Get Billy and Ella out from under that! Harry Regent held Grace's shoulder. It's not the captain's fault. There is nothing to be done now. She would only imperil Skythrust if somehow she tried to land. Even if she stayed around. Not her fault. It's not even the volcano's fault, in any sense. A volcano is a dumb mechanism, with no more volition than a gun whose trigger you pull. It's not its fault. He rubbed Grace's back. His voice was insistent now, Mel thought. Seductive, even. She felt uncomfortable to hear it. As if he was leading Grace to some conclusion in this awful, vulnerable moment. Harry, maybe it's better if you let Grace deal with this in her own way. He ignored her. It's Galaxias, he said. That is the one responsible, Grace. Galaxias, whose warning to get us to stay in line has resulted in this. Death and destruction. The destruction of your sister's home, your niece's home. Maybe their deaths. It's Galaxias's fault. Mel and Jane shared a look that overrode their own differences. What is he trying to do with her? Again, the light shifted. Jane turned to see. It's starting. The next stage. As they watched, Jane explained it all in a dull monotone. As the heat of the churning magma at its root finally failed, the ash plume quickly collapsed. The rock fragments, pumice, smoke, gases, ash, all caught up in that huge, failing updraft of heat, suddenly dropped from the sky. The cloud had been so tall, this central fall would take several minutes, Jane said. And around that huge collapse, a dark, lethal blanket spread out across the ground, a grim circle. At its edge was a hot wind, hotter than steam. Laden with glowing fragments of solidified lava, gases, even fragments of volcanic glass. This was a pyroclastic flow, pouring across the landscape at the speed of sound. Jane told them what was happening, down on the ground. Anybody at Ground Zero was gone, vaporized. People further out, if they were in shelter, if they survived the first overwhelming flow, would have to endure 15-20 minutes under the collapsing cloud. No matter how they tried to shelter, even if they escaped the scalding solid rain, they would suffocate in the streets, in their homes, until the air was gone or the buildings collapsed. Mel shifted her position, trying to see the wider panorama. Much of central Naples was already erased by the black mass of the flow she saw, a huge spillage. And even beyond, wider ashfalls began, hot, heavy, kilometres away. People would be pounded by falls of hot stones, a relentless, rustling rain, caving in roofs, burying people. The four of them stood by the window, watching helplessly as Skythrust rose and fled. In the background, still she spoke on, a meaningless whisper from above the ash-choked sky of Earth. We will sail on sunlight, for now. Our acceleration is small, less than a third of 1% of gravity, but we will keep that acceleration constant as the sun recedes by allowing our smart sail to expand, thus catching more and more of the sun's increasingly scattered spawn of photons. Our first target is a location in the Kuiper Belt, 90 astronomical units out, 90 times as far as Earth is from the sun, indeed 3 times further than the orbit of Neptune, outermost planet. There we will seek evidence, at least, of the entity Galaxias. For that is where the sun was taken, on Blink Day. The mission to that point will take more than a year and a month. The plan for now is that we will not decelerate. Not unless we see an obvious target to slow down for. And if we do find nothing, we intend to go on. As far as we need to, as far as we can. Some months further out, however, we will make a transition, when we reach a point where it will be more efficient for us to use our dark energy drive. With this drive, we no longer rely on sunlight, or on any inboard fuel supply. Meanwhile, aboard the habitat itself, our recycling loops are efficiently closed. We have the means to go as far as we like, always knowing that we have the ability to return, however long it may take. Of that long journey we have completed so far, a single day. A day in which our minuscule acceleration has already sent us 100,000 kilometers from Earth. But already we approach a significant milestone. In just 5 days we will pass solar escape velocity, like the pioneers before us. Are you watching, Galaxias? When the hot wind reached the Gulf of Naples and the sea, water was flashed to steam. Across the coasts of the Mediterranean, tsunamis rolled. In the days that followed, a fine but persistent ash fell across the city suburbs and beyond, eventually accumulating enough weight to crush surviving buildings, smother any fleeing people, and bury their homes and crops. Across tens of kilometres. The first estimates were that 3 million humans died in the first days. A history more than 3,000 years deep erased. It was a new Pompeii, people said. In the nights aboard the silent Skythrust, Mel held her daughter for hours as Jane wept, then finally slept.